We know that no one can succeed alone. Since the Second World War, more than 120,000 Norwegian women and men have served shoulder to shoulder with friends and allied forces. They have participated in almost 100 missions, fighting for values on which we build our societies. A bridge of trust has been built between our brothers in arms and our allied countries. Some soldiers did not make it home, and many suffered injuries. A few have been honored as war heroes. None should be forgotten.
Welcome to a new episode in the series Friends and Allies, where we interview allies and good friends of the Norwegian forces that have interacted with them in some sort of way. And with me today, I have Lee Gamble from Edinburgh, Scotland. Welcome, Lee.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
You are currently serving as a sergeant major in Scotland.
Yeah, the 2nd Battalion, the Royal Regiment of Scotland.
And recently you have also been a part of the Operation Interflex, educating and training Ukrainian soldiers for their struggle in the war with Russia.
Yes, we did, yeah.
But we can start in the other end.
Yeah.
How did you end up in the armed forces in the first place?
So I actually joined the army at 16 years old, so junior entry. I still remember the day I actually sat in school, so sat in higher education, and you know, I just ended up taking the day off school, and before you know it, I was in the careers office. So volunteered, just walked in. That was around about December. I had a chat with someone, and before you know it, I got a call to go and do a selection process that we go through at Glencorse Barracks, just to go and do a little run, a couple of medicals. And before you know it, the phone call came in, and I was like, "What are you doing in February?" I was like, "Oh, not much." "Well, you're about to start training." So I came in pretty fast, 16 years old.
And you followed in the footsteps of your older brother, as I understand.
Yes. So he served with the Royal Scots at the time. So he had done about 3 or 4 years, was still in actually when I was there, going through my training. So he was kind of the saving factor on what regiment it was that I was going to join at the time.
Joining at 16, I mean, a lot of young people are still trying to grow up, and suddenly you were wearing the uniform and started. How did your family react to that?
Yeah, I think they were pretty happy to see me go, actually. So, no, it was interesting. It probably helped a bit, to be honest. I'd kind of always kind of known that I was going to join at one point. In all honesty, I originally went to join just to take a bit of a break from education at the time. Kind of realised I was semi good at it, so they had to sign the paperwork actually, because it was a junior entry, and they, thinking back now, they signed it pretty quick. So,
and of course you went through all sort of training in Scotland, and later on you served in various positions, I assume.
Yeah.
Did you ever have a thought that you might be deployed overseas or in other region?
Yes. So, I mean, my brother at the time had already served in Iraq. He was over there when he was 18, quite young. And we, quite early doors, actually, began our training in a place in Lyd to go to Northern Ireland. And that changed over 24 hours, actually. We all got pulled in for a briefing where we're told, well, we're not training for Northern Ireland anymore, we're training for Iraq. And that hit home pretty quick, actually. Quite excited, to be honest. Probably a bit gullible, but...
Yeah, well, that's the young man's immortality kicking in. Yeah,
definitely.
So you went to Iraq. How was that? How did you feel, or how was that meeting with going to Iraq? Did it affect you? Or can you remember when you first went there?
I can absolutely remember. I can still remember getting on the flight actually from Edinburgh Airport, and we actually went in the back gate into the airport at the time, which I thought was interesting. And believe it or not, actually, my first ever plane was this flight flying out to Iraq.
So first time on an airplane, and you ended up in Iraq.
In Iraq, first ever time. And I tell my son that all the time, by the way, and how lucky he is. So, but no, I remember flying into Dubai at the time, or was it Cyprus? Actually, Cyprus, to get the change of the flights. And I still remember to this day the flight landing into Iraq. You obviously had to fly in when it was dark. And we just remember everybody coming along telling you to shut your curtains or shut the blinds on them, get your body armor and helmet on. They dimmed all the lights, and you know that memory of kind of first landing into Iraq at 18 years old in the pitch black with the lights off, body armor and helmet on, will absolutely stick with me.
Yeah, because today when you're flying, it's quite opposite. You have to turn the light on and open the blinds.
That's it. Trees up.
So how was the Iraq experience? Was that any drama, any particular thing happening?
Do you know, it was fairly quiet, this one, for Telex 7. So we operated in Baghdad from the Green Zone, doing escort taskings out into the embassy. Pretty quiet. Probably not a bad tour to go on your first one. I mean, the threat level was still there. We were on the escort task and it's not allowed to have vehicles within like 50 meters of us because of the risk of the suicide bombers at the time. So it was interesting trying to go through the city centre of Baghdad and trying to keep all these vehicles and people as far away from your car as possible at 18 years old. Putting a billet into the engine block of a car for getting too close and stuff was pretty fun, actually. Shouldn't probably say that, but you know.
fun is the word, yeah. Well, okay, yeah, right.
But yeah, then we moved to a place called Shaiba Log Base and done a whole load of escort taskings from there into Basra and route to the border and heading into Kuwait and stuff. So, been a fair wee bit.
Yeah, so you traveled a distance, actually, during all this period.
Yeah, we got to see quite a bit of the country, actually. And back then when we had the snatches, you're up in top cover as well, so you actually got some quite incredible views, to be fair.
Yeah, well, that's a way to putting it. Yeah. And then your next deployment, that was Afghanistan.
Yeah, Afghanistan Operic 12, yeah, 2010.
And that was a sort of a more different environment.
Yeah, very. The whole operation was different from the first one I had done. I was actually late getting out there, to be honest. I was on a promotion course at the time to get my Lance Corporal, so I was on Junior NCO cadre. So I missed the first month. And yeah, I went out a little bit late, pretty hot, into Nadi Ali, from there straight into a PB Pimon, it was called at the time, still being quite established. I think later on, actually, another trip we went out, it was still growing. And we operated from there for 6 months, Helmand Province and Nadi Ali.
How was the threat level then? Because I know that in 2010, that year, things started building up all over Afghanistan.
Yeah, it was interesting, actually, because when we first got there, when the battalion first got there, it was pretty quiet. And I still remember the moment that, or the day that kind of switched and it all kind of kicked off, was there was a supply run going past us. One of our call saints actually that was involved in an IED at the time, and obviously damaged the vehicle. They got it recovered. And from that day on, that was it. It was just almost daily fights for pretty much the rest of the tour.
Yes, you had a lot of contacts.
Yeah, a lot of contacts. We identified a route, a junction in particular as well, Bravo Delta 13, that we knew that as soon as we went anywhere near this junction, that we were going to get into a bit of a contact at the time. So,
and all these contacts, were they dramatical? Did you feel that this is really bad, or more like I can handle it? I mean, you are professionals, right?
Yeah. We do a lot of training. It's repeated. So I would go as far as saying that almost you didn't really think about it that much. You know, when something happened, it just kind of happened. It was almost just like training again. You know, it was fine until it wasn't fine, if you get what I mean. But I mean, like you'd go out, you would do it, have a bit of a fight, you'd come back to your checkpoint and you would crack on playing FIFA again, or, you know, having a chat. It kind of becomes a normal little bit.
Sort of a normal day's work, actually.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And interesting, hot and heavy.
But there had to be moments where you were more than a normal day at the office that really hit you.
Yeah. When I'm asked this question, it always takes me back to one particular evening, actually. It was quite late on in the tour itself. I think we'd actually had about 3 weeks to go. And that junction I'd mentioned earlier, we decided that, or it was decided that we needed to take the compound on that junction to try and push them further back. So we weren't particularly happy. About 3 weeks to go, moving up to try and take this compound. And we had a patrol that night. And it was that late on in the tour that we actually had two of the advance party that were coming over from, I think it was the Royal Irish Regiment at the time, that were coming over to do start the takeover. And went on a patrol daily, left the compound straight through the bazaar with the marketplace that was there, quite quiet. And we were walking along the irrigation ditch. Now, we used the irrigation ditches to move just with the threat of IEDs. So we're kind of walking along with mud and water up to our knees at this point, carrying your kit on your back, sometimes upwards of 40 kilograms. And I just still remember we were walking along and it came over the radio that there was a bit of movement up ahead. And then as soon as he finished that sentence, it was like all hell broke loose. The noise was absolutely surreal at the time. And I was about the sort of sixth man back on the patrol that night. And what had actually happened is, as we were walking on this irrigation ditch, we needed to be on the other side of the track. So the first two, which so happened to be my friend Dove, his nickname, and one of the Royal Irish guys that were coming over to take over us, were the first two crossing the road, and the Tushka just opened up, shot down. And one of the other, I can't remember what they were firing at the time, PKM probably, had came and had shot both the guy who had only been in Afghan about a week and my friend Dove. Took two casualties on the road, and we were fighting for hours, it felt like. I mean, we left and it was daylight, and it was pitch black when we were trying to come back in.
That was a long day.
Yeah, long day. And we had obviously called in for some help as well, but because of where we were in the trees, it was actually quite difficult for them to come in. So they were kind of hovering, the Apaches were hovering at a bit of a distance in the hope that even the noise of them coming over at that point would be enough to kind of push the Taliban back. But they stayed there and they fought for quite a while until we tried to do the Kazifak to get out, which is quite a funny story.
How did you manage to extract yourself from that?
Yeah, this was the funny part, actually, which I still kind of laugh about today. But of my friend that had been shot, he had been shot through the calf. And actually, he managed to move himself for about 50 metres, running as well, until just the adrenaline kind of pushing him through, until I had to pick him up. And we're running along, we're outside the irrigation ditch at this point, just to kind of get moving. The ground in the irrigation ditch with mud up to your knees and trying to carry someone through it was like, it was near impossible. We weren't getting anywhere. So we got out, we're running along the tree line to get back, still under contact at the time. And I could feel Dove slipping down my right side when we were running.
Yeah, because you had him on your back.
I had him on my back, over my shoulders. And I still had my kit on my back as well. He still got his body armour, all the usual stuff. So, I mean, it was a fair weight to be carrying. And he was slipping down and I was like, right, on three, I'm going to push you up, because he was about to fall off. And lo and behold, we got to three. And I think just the sheer adrenaline, I'd kind of pushed him up and he went flying off the other side. Both of us rolling about the ground, getting shot at in stitches. Baby, we were laughing our heads off. I'm trying to apologise to him for dropping him. He's laughing because we're still being shot at the time. And yeah, that's just one memory that will probably stick with me, and just how bizarre, how surreal the whole experience was.
Obviously, you made it out, yeah. and your friend also, so he got on a treatment.
Yeah, so we managed to get both him and the guy who was over for the advance party back to the PB. We're actually only about 400 metres, 450 metres away for the checkpoint at the time. So we managed to get them back, and they got Kazivat both fine. Dove made an actual surprisingly quick and full recovery back to running and normal jogging.
Sometimes you are in a bit of luck, aren't you?
Yeah, absolutely.
So how did the rest of the period, was it like, you told earlier that you were still in contact every day, you had incidents every day. Was that to the very last minute you served?
Absolutely. And I mean, even though we came back in that night, we had to go back out again and take over the compound. Like, it was a must. So we kind of came back in, we rejigged and went back. And for the last 3 weeks, that compound just got absolutely smashed. Now, I wasn't in that compound. We took over and we left one half of our team up there, and then we stayed where we were on the junction before. So they were up there. I mean, they had UGLs getting fired and the people throwing grenades over the wall. And they had that for the rest of the 3 weeks of the tour until we were replaced before we left.
Yeah, well, that's a harsh memory to take home with you.
Yeah, especially when it was right at the end as well. You know, like you're kind of thinking it was fun. I mean, we took a few casualties, not from our regiment, but we were working alongside other regiments there at the time. They had taken a few in the same area as us. We had everything felt like it was going quite well. It was exciting. I would say potentially.
Yeah, well, that's a bit of an underrating. After that tour, you went back to Scotland.
Yes, went back.
And I presume you kept on doing service inland.
Yes. So we, to be fair, I was only back for a couple of years at that point, and then we went back to Afghanistan again. So I had actually, in between that, had almost left the army at that point. I'd signed off, given my notice, thought I've done enough now, and I was asked by hire to stay and do one more tour of Afghan. So I thought, okay, I'll do one more. So we went back out to Helmand again. It was a bit of a quieter tour, this one. Still another 7 months in a place called Gireshk near Fort Price. It was we still had a few fights, a couple of contacts here and there throughout the duration of it. Unfortunately, we had a couple, or at least one in particular, Captain Walter Barry, who had unfortunately been killed while playing a game of football in Afghan during that one. So it was tough to take.
Yeah, well, all those incidents are a thing you bring with you.
Yeah.
Okay, so you served the second tour, or your that was your last tour to Afghanistan?
Yes, to Afghanistan. And again, I'd actually came home and I thought, right, I said I'd do one more, and I thought I'm going to leave now. And it took for my wife to take me out one day and sit me down and be like, "You need to decide now. Are you in or are you out?" And here I am, so still in 21 years later.
You're still in, yeah. But you went finished with your deployments abroad because you had another totally different deployment,
different experience actually. So out to Somalia, two rotations out there as a training team actually. Through Mogadishu and then up into a place called Baidoa, where we trained the Somali National Army we kind of ran basic training for them, just to enable them to kind of go out and do their own patrols and start to establish their own military footprint.
Is that how you got into the training of the forces sort of tasks?
Yeah, that was actually I mean, we had done bits. We do a lot of exercise deployments to Kenya, where we work with the Kenyans and stuff over there. Not so much doing a lot of training with them, but a lot of working alongside them. But this was probably my first step into actually instructing and training in other nations.
And just to jump forward, you are recently finished a training program for the Ukrainian soldiers.
Yeah.
With the Operation Interflex.
Yes, that's right.
Which also involved Norwegian soldiers and instructors working with and for you.
Yeah, absolutely.
In that, how is it working? Is it giving results?
Yeah, I think we're absolutely getting results. I mean, I think the main thing was to try and improve or increase the survivability of them more than anything else. You know what I mean? Like, I think, I can't remember the exact stats off my head, but I know that they weren't particularly lasting that long, you know, and if we were able to provide them enough training while they were there to give them another week or something where they can stay in the fight, then you know, then you're getting the results. And that kind of what our main focus was that lethality, but the survivability as well.
Do you have in the back of your head that the people I'm training now, those particular soldiers from Ukraine, just in a couple of weeks, they are going to most likely be on the front line and fighting for their lives against a formidable enemy?
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, during that training or the courses that we were running, they actually came with those that the Ukrainians were to put in as instructors as well. So, you know, a lot of them had already been to the front line and had already been fighting. So they were actually feeding a lot of knowledge into us as well, for us to sort of adapt our training with them, but also to the conscripts and that were coming through. And I mean, You'd see them day one when they arrive, and you know, some of them were much older guys, kind of preparing to go over there. Probably a lot of them volunteers. There was a lot of conscripts in there as well. But you felt the average age throughout the courses and stuff started to increase a bit.
The instructor team, as I said earlier, also includes Norwegian soldiers. How do your military experience from the UK, is it diversifying a lot from what the Norwegian are bringing? Do you have a different approach to how you go to the task of doing the soldiering or the what you're bringing to the table?
Yeah, so even in Wovgil, which was the place where we were providing some of the training for the Ukrainians, but my job was the G7 warrant officer, which is the training warrant officer at that point. So I would oversee the programs and give the programs out to the training teams. Now, we had two Norwegian training teams at that point working with us that were there. So we would have daily meetings in the morning talking about what they were going to be achieving that day, how they were going to be delivering their training. We would organize things for me to go and visit their training and making sure that everything was going all right. And we had quite a lot of, actually two really good teams from the Norwegian lot that we were working with. And yeah, we would basically go through the programs. I would work out the bookings with them, because obviously they would be going from their exercises out in the field to taking them onto the ranges and delivering them the live firing package. And I would oversee the sort of safety assurance piece to make sure, because you can imagine some of the Ukrainians that were coming over and the Norwegian teams are having to train up and shoot for the very first time. So you had people trying to shoot with the wrong eye and wrong hands and stuff, you know, so you actually got a bit of a joke from it. So my job was just to assure it and make sure that everybody was delivering the correct package, but safely as well. And, you know, the teams were absolutely all over it and no issues at all.
My impression is that it's quite intensive training that you have to put these soldiers through. And is that reflecting high level of quality for the instructors?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it must take a lot because, I mean, they're trying to squeeze a lot of training into such a short period of time. And I don't doubt, I know that they wanted longer. You know, I've had teams come up and they've asked to have could this course be longer? But obviously they needed them trained and straight back on the next flight and straight back over there. So the fact that they were able to achieve what they did in the time frame is outstanding.
How's the interaction between the Ukrainians, the training leaders from Norway and the Dutch people, and also you? Do you interact very closely, or is it like separate things?
Yeah, so from my side, I wouldn't interact too much with the Ukrainian trainees at the time, but I know for a fact that the training teams were. And you could actually see that the relationships were kind of formed, actually, and they would be. And you know, it must be hard for the training teams with the teams that were over there delivering the training, knowing, you know, they're probably trying not to get too close to them because they know that they're about to go and jump on the next flight and go straight to the front line. But you could see it. You know, we would have a mini parade for them when they were leaving to get on the coaches to go back, and you know, we'd line the roads for them, and you had all the Norwegian training teams lining up both sides of the road, and you know, and applauding them as they're leaving, saluting them as they're leaving. You know, you could see the flags, Norwegian and Ukrainian flag together, and the British flag up there as well. And it's a strange feeling, but there was definitely relationships formed, and it must be pretty tough.
What are your personal views on the war that you are attending people to go to? Do you have any feeling of how it's turning out?
I mean, not to get too much into it. I mean, no one wants to see a war. You know, I mean, it doesn't matter what country you're from. And I think that's kind of where my stance is that I would much prefer there wasn't a war. How it's paying off, how it's going. I mean, fair play. I mean, it's a whole different kind of warfare that we're starting to experience now. And if anything, it's helping us learn with what's going on over there. And we're having to adapt our training and stuff like that from it. But I mean, no one wants a war. I think we would all prefer that ended pretty soon.
Yeah, well, it's still there.
Yeah, it's still there. And I think it's going to be there for a while as well. Hopefully with what's going on, it will start to ease off a little bit and they'll come to some sort of agreement. But I think it's opened my eyes, especially with how the wars are being fought. I mean, we all thought trench warfare was a thing of the past, you know, and it's something that they are literally doing every day now in the trenches, which, you know, we've not seen since like World War II. And to think that that's how they're living and operating now in a war over there in 2025 is wild, wild.
So there's another aspect with all this, and that's for you being a career soldier, spending your working days in the army. You have a family. How is that functioning for you with you doing what you do and the family have to hold the fort, so to say?
Yeah, I've got a wife and two kids, 6 and 8 years old as well, so quite a challenging time regardless of me being away and stuff. But yeah, going away became different. Even the shorter exercises, where it might be a couple of months or even a few weeks, became a lot harder, because you're not only just going away and leaving one person at home, you're now going away leaving three people at home. And when we moved from England up to Scotland, when I came back to the 2nd Battalion, I was home a week and I deployed for 4 months to Oman for an exercise. And, you know, my wife had moved back up with two kids back into our house, had to sort out the schools, had to sort out the decorating of the house, had to deal with my son leaving his friends, changing school, and doing it all by themselves. And I mean, hat off to her, because I mean, trying to do that on your own, moving home and moving lives basically, while I'm just sunning it away in Oman somewhere, you know. It's tough. I mean, they do well. I think my son does. He took it pretty bad. He's obviously a little bit older at the time when we had moved up. Easy for my daughter, but Saxon was it was tough. It was a tough time actually, that one. Too much happening all at once, and these dads away for 4 months. So these trips away become more and more difficult every time.
If you can have go back at leave when I was 16, would you do it all over again, or would you choose staying in school and be a carpenter?
Oh, that's a really good question. Really good question. No, I think I'd do it all over again. I mean, there's certain things I would maybe do in my career a little bit different, but I think I would still join. I think I'd still go for it. I've learned so much and experienced so much for to go another route, I think. And I've got to do my bit. But would I maybe stay on at school another couple of years? You know, maybe, potentially. But no, I don't think I would change too much.
In Friends and Allies, we hear the stories of some of our closest supporters, reliving with them some of their most intense moments. Et øyeblikk, en evighet.